Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Norman. I'm back. Have you all missed me?
Tons. Absolutely shed loads.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happened without me?
We had Paul and Brooker together again, and you know how that normally ends. But they actually did a fantastic job together. Paul was great. And then last week, Tony Black hosted, and we had the guys Ben and Daryl from Sudden Double Deep, who were also pretty good. And I would, I've invited them both back again in the future. But, you know, obviously, Steve, now you're back, we can run a tighter ship and things will be less self-congratulatory, I'm sure. And it will all just go smoothly.
There are plenty of needless backslapping now I'm back.
Yeah. Loads of it.
So, yes, I'm back and I'm joined by Owen Hughes.
Yes, that was me talking just now.
Yes, doing all that chatting. And Callum Petch.
Hello.
As we take a crack at the last week or so in film with a review of Sausage Party to end the podcast. Bet we're all looking forward to that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. What a party it will be.
Yeah, full of sausage.
Sausage party meets podcast party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's how all of our podcasts have been since Carol left, basically, aren't they? Just all sausage parties.
Yes, have we had a single female voice on this since Carol left?
Oh, man. When was Holly Tronsden on? She was on talking about Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Mm.
I think that was it. That was ages ago as well.
We are a very white male podcast.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
we are not ticking any boxes anywhere.
No, but you know, we're not elitist. We're not all privately educated Etonians, so there's that.
No, just me and Paul.
Yeah.
Are you trying to say we're the oasis of podcasts, Owen? Is that what you're trying to say?
In a roundabout sort of way. Yeah, sure. We're
So what you're trying to say is our first 3 years were phenomenal and fantastic and unbeatable, and then it's just a downward slide from there, is that?
We're going to slide away. Yeah.
God damn it.
Yep.
I wish I'd never come back.
I tried so hard to not give him the satisfaction of the laugh there, and I couldn't do it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Puns. You just set them up, I'll knock them down. That's how they work.
Anyway, let's crack on. Because I've prepared a quiz, and apparently I'm already 1-0 down.
Oh, yes, you are.
And it's Owen versus Callum trying to win points on my behalf. So with Sausage Party being the main review,
mm-hmm.
I have themed my quiz around films with food in the title.
Right.
I thought that was the obvious choice there for your for your film choice, for your quiz choice even.
Realistically, and in hindsight, I should have done films, a quiz based around films where there's a party. But no.
Yeah.
You could have done an entire quiz based just on the works of Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, since they've been involved in pretty much every film for the last 10 years at this point.
I could have done
films with sausages in them.
Yes. name one other than Sausage Party, Owen.
Wiener. I made that one up. I don't even know if it's a film. Porkies? How about that one?
I'll let you have Porkies.
Pugsy the dog movie. Because he's a dog and he eats sausages. Because he's a dog. Oh, the guffaws.
Anyway, so what I did was I looked on Box Office Mojo and I looked at the films. So basically, I'm going to name two films that have got food or drink in the title. And you have to tell me, guess which one that has, according to Box Office at Mojo, the highest lifetime gross as of today. So the first one is Milk or Salt?
Milk.
I'm going to go Salt.
Callum is correct with Salt. Salt has grossed $118 million. Milk, $32
million.
Yeah, domestic, because Salt was a proper, you know, wide-release action movie with Angelina Jolie, and Milk was an award season movie, and they never make money.
Yeah, that's true.
Next up, I have got American Pie versus Pineapple Express.
Ooh.
American Pie, surely.
I am going to go... You know what, I don't actually think... I think Pineapple Express was actually kind of a bomb in theaters and only became huge on DVD. I'm going to go American Pie.
Okay, both gone for American Pie. That leaves it, well, at 2-1 to Callum, as American Pie is the correct answer with $103 million. Pineapple Express, $87
million. Ooh.
Not bad.
Next up, we have the Johnny Depp version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, God.
Now, I wanted to take this up against the Gene Wilder version, but it didn't seem to be on the website, so I went with Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs as the one to take it on.
Oh, that's tough.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
I think probably Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
I'm pretty sure Charlie was one of the highest grossing films of 2005. Mm. So I'm going to go Charlie.
It is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. $206 million against $125 million.
Wow. Doubled it nearly.
I'm assuming Johnny Depp was the pull there that kind of got more bums on seats.
Also, this was at the exact point just before people started getting sick of Tim Burton again. He has peaks and valleys, like an actual wave. Like there are times when people really like him, but they all hate him. But for some reason, like him again, then go back to hating.
Yeah,
him again.
you say for some reason, because it's not like he's doing something good in between to like spark an interest and love of him again. He's just producing shit, but he will get a peak.
Well, I mean, recently, yes, but I mean, admittedly, before Charlie suddenly became big again, I actually think Big Fish was actually a really good film, and then, of course, he did do Sweeney Todd, and I liked Sweeney Todd in any case, even with questionable singing from most of the cast, let's face it.
It's one of these that's often held up as a good example of a Tim Burton film. I just didn't get on with that film at all, Sweeney Todd.
Also, Big Eyes is actually quite good the other year. Just putting that out there for people.
Oh, yeah. That one kind of... I mean, I liked Frankenweenie as well, actually. I thought that
I
was quite good.
I haven't seen Frankenweenie. It is here, though. I need to watch it. I've heard great things about it.
It's really... I mean, I'm a big Vincent Price fan as well. So it's obviously appealing to my kind of nostalgia and stuff. But it's great.
I guess it's also the point where I have to admit, even though it's not a Tim Burton film, but I still have yet to actually watch Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. Wow.
Drag me, fail critics listeners. Anyways, let's move on for quiz.
Okay, so that's three down, two left to go. Next up is Chicken Run versus Space Jam. Jam being the food.
Yeah.
Space Jam.
Not space cakes.
although technically,
yeah,
it doesn't in the film. It's not referring to jam, the fruity preserve.
Are you sure you're not describing the porn parody here?
Well,
come on and slam, and welcome to the jam.
Lovely. Yeah, I think it's Space Jam.
Okay, Callum?
I know Chicken Run came in just under 100 million, but Space Jam, I'm pretty sure, made more.
According to Box Office Mojo, you're both wrong. Chicken Run was 106 million, Space Jam just 90.
What?
Okay. You know what? I'm not even mad, but I'm not upset that I got that wrong. I'm happy. I'm very happy.
Yep.
Again, Space Jam literally existing purely as a result of a fucking Nike commercial.
I still like Space Jam, though.
Oh, no, I like Space Jam as well. I just continue to have no idea who that movie is for.
They are making a Space Jam 2, apparently.
No, they're not. They've been saying that for the last two decades.
No, this is genuine. and some other basketball player. LeBron James. Let me say LeBron James until I Google it now and find out differently.
It is LeBron because he was in Trainwreck. Those rumors started up after he got in Trainwreck, and it started up again after Justin Lin mentioned him about the Star Trek Beyond, but he'd like to make a Space Jam sequel for some reason. It's not going to happen for one because Star Trek hasn't made any money, so Lin's probably going in the box office doghouse for the time being.
Way to get out is by making Space Jam 2.
They've been trying to make Space Jam 2 for years. It's not going to happen. And Warner Brothers fucking hates the Looney Tunes anyway.
Football's big now. They should make a Space Jam 2, but with football.
Stop giving them ideas, Steve.
I know. Please. Just let's not give them any more.
Especially since whatever I have to sit through next, we'll have to have a rap song with the 2016 equivalent of Method Man, Be Real, LL Cool J, and Busta Rhymes. And I don't like the sounds of that. I really don't. Oh, and Coolio, who we always forget for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
Just like in life in general, everybody just forgets Coolio.
Anyway, it's 3-2 to Callum at the moment. There's one left.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scraping the barrel when I got to this point because there were some films that they just didn't seem to be on box office mojo for this. Like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes was not on there.
That's a real movie.
Yeah, I've got it on DVD.
But it was
ridiculous.
I didn't get any box office mojo stats for it, so I went with Children of the Corn versus Chocolat.
These are okay. Right, the first one is one of those terrible schlocky B movies.
Yeah,
I think isn't Chocolat? No. I'm going to say Chocolat.
I'm going to have to go the opposite of Callum in the hope that I get a point.
You didn't get a point.
No, I didn't think
Callum has won.
Yep.
Chocolat is the Lassie Halston movie, right?
Chocolat, 71 million. Children of Corn, 15.
Yeah,
Chocolat was a Lassie Halston movie, if I remember.
So Callum, and therefore me, wins the quiz, and it's 1-1 going into next week.
Yeah.
If only I'd trusted my instincts and gone Chicken Run, I could have done a clean sweep there.
Mm.
Which are worth 2 points. Obvious. In this rule, I just made up just now.
I just start getting really ballsy with the quiz now. Like when it's 2-0, I'll go double or quits with Owen and just lose.
Just risk it. I know. Yeah. I've got two films lined up for you to watch, so you can go as ballsy as you like, Steve.
Let's go balls out.
Also, I'm back on next week as well. So maybe start dreaming. You know, start making plans. You never know.
Got to think of the new release and find out the less obvious tie in with that for the quiz rather than the obvious one.
Kubo and the Two Strings next week. And also Hello High Water. We'll do that at the end of the show where we get all hyped about next week's films.
When Owen forgets what's happening next week.
Yeah,
let's move on to news.
Yes, let's move on to news. Where the major bit of news that we've got this week is that Jackie Chan has been given an honorary Oscar. Owen is probably the biggest Jackie Chan fan.
Yep.
That's not racial.
Seeing as it was a genuine mistake and you didn't slip into an Asian accent all of a sudden, then you're fine.
Yeah. Were you poking your fingers towards the edge of your eyes when you were doing that as well?
Yeah, have you seen that picture of Ronaldo at the Japan? What, that was what I was doing at the time. but anyway, no, he's been giving an honorary Oscar. And Owen, you said earlier you were very happy about this decision.
Yeah, only in the sense that I am a big fan of Jackie Chan's and...
you pulled that off well.
What?
Big fan of Jackie Chan. You didn't make any mistakes there.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jackie fan and his work and... It's always nice when people that you admire or you respect are given some recognition or further recognition. I guess partly by the Academy because it's seen as such a prestigious award. But I'm glad to see him picking up this little bit of gold from them. Ultimately it's pretty meaningless, isn't it? Because he's never actually been nominated for anything. It's just like when Roger Corman got an Oscar and, you know, as seems to happen every so often, the people that they have overlooked for so long, they just go, yeah, we can't let this happen. It's like when John Wayne won an Oscar. It was effectively because they go, well, we haven't given any Oscars yet, even though we probably should.
I thought he won for True Grit.
He got one for True Grit, yeah. But that was 1969.
I thought you were talking just in terms of honorary Oscars in general.
No, he wouldn't. No, just, I mean, like, they kind of felt bad about the whole John Wayne thing and gave him an Oscar in the end for True Grit. I mean, True Grit is good, but it's not his best performance.
I mean, you could also describe that to basically 90% of awards that are won of the Oscars every year recently now, can't you?
I guess so. Yeah, DiCaprio was one.
DiCaprio,
wasn't he?
McConaughey.
Performance. Yeah, yeah. But,
still, nothing honorary wise will top the time when Walt Disney won honorary Oscars for Snow White instead of actually being eligible to be nominated for anything.
Yeah. Mm. So back onto the topic of Jackie Chan, how do you guys feel about him getting an honorary Oscar? Not bothered? Think it's great? Think it's ridiculous? What's the general opinion?
I just like to see Western releases of his Chinese directed films. That'd be nice.
Yes.
Mm. I mean, could they have not done it at the next Oscar ceremony to give it a bit more? Kind of
honorary Oscars, I believe, don't actually get nominated, don't get handed out anywhere near the ceremony itself. So this is basically just par for course.
Yeah,
it's sort of like, remember, we're still a thing, we exist, and we judge all your films. Here's an honorary Oscar.
In any case, whatever happens, it's nice that he's got some kind of recognition. Because I mean, of course, none of his actual, you know, films and that, they got recognition, because the ones that made him a household name are the kind of films the Academy never touches with a 20-foot pole. So it's still nice for him to get a recognition in any case, although it's just further evidence that awards are meaningless, because Jackie Chan was always going to be loved and remembered far more than that guy who won the Dallas Buyers Club the other year. Not the leading one, the supporting one. You know, that one guy who goes off, plays in a band every now and again, can't remember his name, kind of a douche, if I remember. Just escaped.
Mm-hmm. Save them all. Yep. The thing about Jackie Chan as well is that he's one of these who's mentioned in the past, as well as Jason Statham's been a big fan of this, about stunt actors not getting awards, and there's no category for them. You know, and the stunts that Jackie Chan, well, obviously he doesn't really do so much anymore, but throughout the sort of 80s into the 90s, were absolutely insane, and he would get no actual recognition from the Academy for stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. But, you know, if he should be nominated for an Oscar, I mean, he's not the best actor in the world. Yes, he can be really funny. He's got good comic timing and all that, but
he has amazing comic timing. So much harder to pull off than people think.
Yeah.
There. So don't try and undersell him as an actor. Okay, He's still is. Cause thankfully, thankfully, 2016 hasn't taken him, unlike everybody else.
Yeah.
So mostly his roles in Western films, comedies, does he
bumbling sidekick kind of thing?
Yeah, does he in his kind of non-Western films, does he keep up with that, or does he do more serious? Is he completely different?
He does a lot of like proper epics. I think he tries to do more serious drama stuff as well. He said about it must have been about 10 years ago that he was pretty much done with kind of slapstick comedy and these action films that he's been doing. He basically said, I don't want any more of these. I want to, you know, I'm older now. I'll get tired more easily. I can't keep doing these stunts all the time. And he wanted to do more kind of romantic dramas. I don't think the romantic dramas ever panned out, because let's face it, it would be a bit creepy.
But hey, he's deserved the chance now, basically, to be able to just stop and do whatever he wants as well. And obviously making the smart decision of getting out while he can still, you know, so he's not spending his last years in a wheelchair or anything. So,
yeah, well, he did Shinjuku Incident, which was pretty good. That's mainly, I mean, there is a little bit of action in it, but no more so than a normal kind of thriller. He was really good in that. He did Three Kingdoms, which was a pretty big epic film. I think it's actually made its way onto Netflix now as well. He does churn out a lot of movies, so much so that he's, you know, was it 60 something million pounds he made last year? It was the second highest grossing actor. So, I mean, you know, he's still raking it in, whatever he's doing.
Other news, London Film Festival has had its lineup announced. And Callum, I think you were wishing that you were able to go to a few of the...
I put this way, have absolutely not been spending the last week putting together a dream list of what I would see if I could go for all the weeks, but both the weeks, but I have actually decided to cash in all my what few remaining funds I do have to be able to go down for a couple of days and watch films, because tickets are quite expensive.
Yes.
But in any case, for those of you who don't know, London Film Festival running from the 4th of October through to the 17th of October, playing all around London. I've had a run through the entire list here as well. I've got a personal set of lists of their films I'd like to see if I could, but I'll run through some of the big names that people are there, big ones. Opening the festival is A United Kingdom, which is a romantic drama starring Rosamund Pike and David Oyelowo. I believe it's getting some decent awards buzz. It doesn't strike me as opening night material either, but it's also apparently a drama about interracial love as well. So that's probably going to do interest.
Okay.
Presumably, that's here because they couldn't get Jeff Nichols Loving, I guess. So... Oh god, I'm really annoyed. Loving in the UK is of course going to be postponed until next year, because otherwise we could have had two Jeff Nichols movies this year. Two, that would have been so over. And closing the festival for you BFI members who are eligible for the ticket ballot instead of the rest of us filthy commoners who don't get the chance is the European premiere of Ben Wheatley's Free Fire. I am incredibly bitter about the fact that even if I were able to go, I would not be able to see Free Fire. Jealous. So jealous. That's coming out next year.
I don't think I've ever seen a Ben Wheatley film in the cinema. I'm kind of gutted about that. I don't think it will ever happen because they don't seem to make it to the cinema.
I only got very lucky by being able to see High Rise because of the Hull Independent Cinema Project. That there, because High Rise completely skipped Hull, but they managed to get it screened there for that one-off special screening and that there. So I mean, it was in a theatre, you know, like a proper, you know, theatre and that there, which does plays, which just shows film in a little side cupboard, basically. But I got to see High Rise on a cinema screen, and you know what? It's gorgeous. So there we go. Other films out here as well, a big gala premiere, so to speak. There is the premiere of Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea. Kenneth Lonergan of Margaret from a few years back, that long delay film that was apparently actually really great. Manchester by the Sea has been tearing it up with through festivals over the past year. I think A.I.E. Dowd of the AV Club especially has called it a masterpiece and his favourite film of the year so far. And it's not actually out anywhere yet, so that'll be interesting. There's Damien Chazelle's La La Land, follow-up to Whiplash, a old-fashioned Hollywood-style musical about an aspiring jazz pianist played by Ryan Gosling and an aspiring actress played by Emma Stone falling in love. That's been doing really well. We also have Paterson, the new Jim Jarmusch film with Adam Driver. Turner's Birth of the Birth of a Nation. Denis Villeneuve's Arrival. I'm specifically timing my day that I go to London so I can just get in and watch Arrival. I don't care. It's out exactly a month to the day after it's being shown out there. If I get a chance to see a Denis Villeneuve movie early, I'm going to take that opportunity. Oliver Stone's Snowden is also one of the premieres there as well, and there's about other films around here that are a bit lower down that I'd like to point out for people as opportunity as well. Paul Verhoeven's L, the rape revenge movie about a female video game executive who goes on revenge against her tormentors, which, since it's by Paul Verhoeven, will only be handled in the classiest of ways, like I could tell.
But I mean, that's kind of his.
No,
stick,
I know,
though, isn't it?
That's actually I'm actually really looking forward to it. Oliver Sykes' Personal Shopper, which is Kristen Stewart's ghost story, which has drawn equal parts raves and boos, so and quite claims of genius and pretentious. So you've got that. Ava DuVernay's The 13th, which is a documentary about the 13th Amendment, about America's how the American justice system is predominantly weighted against black people as well. That's coming to Netflix, I believe, a short while afterwards, but it's getting a premiere at London Film Festival as well. So there's that. Speaking of Netflix movies that are also getting screenings there, Christopher Guest's Mascots is getting a screening there as well. Mike Birbiglia's Don't Think Twice is playing there as well, comedy drama about an improv group with Birbiglia, Gillian Jacobs, Hugh Michael Key. It looks phenomenal, apparently it is great. Both Christine and Kate Plays Christine are playing at the festival as well, which Christine is a fictionalized, it is a biopic, and Kate Plays Christine is a documentary about Christine Chubbuck, who was a television journalist who killed herself, who shot herself and killed herself live on air in the 1970s. Christine is a fictionalized drama version, with Christine being played by Rebecca Hall. Kate Plays Christine is a documentary about an actress supposedly preparing for the role in a film version of her story, but apparently starts blurring the lines between documentary and fiction very quickly. Both have been getting raves. Very excited to see that. Tower, which is a documentary about the University of Texas sniper shootings in the year from back in 1966, which tells the story both through standard interviews, recreations, and animation, and animated rotoscoped animations of the shootings themselves. That's been getting a lot of big praises. The Pass, which is a drama about two football players who, the night before a big game, find themselves having to share a hotel room and possibly giving in to homosexual urges with each other, that could change their dynamic forever. That's been getting good reviews. Trespass Against Us, which is a new Adam Smith film. Adam Smith, who's collaborated with the Chemical Brothers a lot as well, but they're a crime drama with Michael Fassbender, Brendan Gleeson, and a new score by the Chemical Brothers as well. As Raw, which is a movie about a vegan, young vegan woman who is forced by her male friends to eat some meat and turns into a cannibal as a result, as you do. Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women is playing there as well. Stopover, which is a French drama about a regiment of French soldiers on their way back from Afghanistan to stop over back in Cyprus, as the two female members of their team ends up becoming victims of sexual harassment and misogyny. Its directors and screenwriters, Delphine and Marielle Coulin, won Best Screenplay at Cannes for that as well. So there's that. And finally, because yes, I'm wrapping up now, we can all move on with our lives here. Revenge as well, which is the new film from Alice Lowe, who you might know as the co-writer and star of Ben Wheatley's Sightseers, which is a thriller about a pregnant woman who believes that her unborn child is telling her to kill people. What's notable here is not just for the lunacy of that premise, is the fact that it's actually is that Lowe plays lead actress and was 7 months pregnant at the time of directing, writing, starring in that movie as well. So it sounds crazy in any case, yeah. As well as another piece of quiet female empowerment there. So I'm looking at that's just some of this utterly ridiculous list. That does not include, I completely forgot to mention, The Handmaiden, the new Park Chan-wook film, is also playing there. God, I want to see that so badly because it's Park Chan-wook. I need to watch Stoker again. I haven't watched Stoker in a while. Stoker was great. That's just some of the list of the giant amount of films that are playing at the festival. It's a good list. It's a nice outside list. And if somebody would like to either help secure me a press pass or pay for me to be able to just go and see all the films there forever, then I will love you forever. I promise you high quality articles. Maybe not high quality, but some the kind of quality you usually associate with me. Okay, so I can promise you that.
Also, in film festival news, Isle of Man Film Festival is happening on a probably smaller scale than the London one.
It is a little bit, but we've got Matt Lamborn, who has been on the podcast loads. He's based out of the Isle of Man, but he's actually judging one of the categories over there. Is judging the best short comedy. So there's a lot going on. It's taking place on Thursday this week, 8th of September. Starts at 7 p.m, I believe. And they've got things like an outdoor screening of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and Labyrinth at a castle. So I'm sure that'll be pretty awesome. They've got a Q&A with the prop designer from Stranger Things, a Q&A with Mark Kermode, who'll be interviewing a special guest, who we don't know who that is yet. It'll be announced at the time. Loads of stuff, loads of films showing there. It's well worth having a quick look if you're out that way. And of course, Matt will be bringing us articles on the website about what's going on and what won the category
really
he's judging, of course.
He treats it like when Homer Simpson became film critic.
Yes.
I like a man gets hit in football and groin with football.
Yeah.
Because a man getting hit in the groin with a football.
Exactly. I'm sure Matt will be more professional than that. As he always...
I don't know. Is there a short film of a man being hit in the groin with a football?
Well, I'm sure as he is judging best short comedy, if not, then we should submit one quickly before the deadline.
Anyway, so that is film festivals happening all over the beautiful British Isles that we're attending in part. Time now for what we've been watching, where we take a look at some of the films we've all seen over the last week or so. I'm going to start off. I've seen The Butterfly Effect, starring Ashton Kutcher, who now seems to have disappeared from all film and TV work, but does some advert for some computers.
Charlie Sheen probably killed him.
And there's an advert he does with a dancing slice of pizza or something. I don't know. He still does adverts, but it's like a reverse child actor, like successful to start with, and then gets worse and less and less. But anyway, he was in The Butterfly Effect, which is a time travel film, which grasped my attention straight away, because anything involving time travel that's less complicated than Primer is a thumbs up in my book. I need to watch Primer again, because I did not get it the first time. It might melt my brain.
Read the graph that's online and then watch it again.
I've tried
reading the graph. Oh, gee, I don't know about you, but I can't enjoy a movie unless I've read a very long graph the entire before I actually sit down and watch said movie. Yeah, that's what I need. It's like if to be able to properly enjoy Lord of the Rings in the cinema, they just handed out giant cliff notes of useless facts as you went in and out there and told you to read it whilst the film was going on.
Just gave you the appendices of Return of the King and said, right, before you just read that.
Uh-huh. Read all 20 about, there'll be a quiz. You'll need to get a certain score before we'll play the film.
Yeah. But no, The Butterfly Effect. So, Ashton Kutcher is somebody who, I think he's inherited this from his father, this kind of ability to, by reading back through his old diaries, travel back in time to, different times, inhabit his body at that age and change what happened. And he does this a few times with positive effects, negative effects, differing effects, trying to change his past to help himself, benefit his friend. And, gets it wrong more often than not. He ends up in prison for certain things. Ends up in psychiatric hospitals. Ends up with no arms from being in the explosion, and all kind of things. And I did enjoy. I don't think I enjoyed it because of any of the performances were particularly excellent. I just think I liked the concept and anything involving time travel. And the plot was quite good. There were a few twists in there. Some very predictable, some not so predictable. There were a few interesting ideas. We spoke about this before. The ending was a bit bland and didn't really fit with the tone of the film for me. But then the alternative ending was just completely mental and probably one more fitting, not fitting. Mm-hmm. But yes.
Made a bit more sense for a mainstream kind of movie.
It seemed like they tried to tack on what was as much of a happy ending as there could have been, which just seemed a bit unnecessary.
It's kind of hilarious they tried to make a mainstream movie about that one. This movie clearly only existed because Donnie Darko suddenly became a thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, it passed me by completely. I'd heard about it, so I know what the butterfly effect is a principle is as well. But I just the film passed me by until looking for something to watch on Netflix, and I settled on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I managed to settle on something that quickly, but
you saw Ashton Kutcher and was like, "Yep, I am down for some Ashton Kutcher." That's what decided it clearly.
Yeah, I've been watching repeats of that 70s show on Five Star. and I just thought, what I need in my life is a bit more Ashton Kutcher. I'm not watching Two and a Half Men post Charlie Sheen, because quite frankly that's an insult to the great man. So what I'm going to do is put on the Butterfly Effect.
And I guess then you thought it was a good choice, because
it was in the end a good choice. Yes, I said the ending does spoil it a bit, but in general it was a thoroughly enjoyable hour, yep. You know, nearly 2 hours. I've heard there are sequels. I've heard not to watch the sequels.
The second, I think it's a second one. The second one is he looks at photographs.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
I've heard it's essentially the same film, but the guy, the protagonist, is a dick.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not like some films where they try to make someone a dick and you go, oh, he's a dick, but at least they've written him that way. It's like he's an absolute tosser, but actually it doesn't seem like they're aware that he's a tosser.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an annoying character and not a very good film at all. It just kind of lacks any of the I wouldn't say charm of the first one, but any of the ambition of it anyway.
Yeah. Next up then, Owen, what have you seen this week?
Well, see, I knew that I had to watch something for this week's podcast.
Well, I mean, that is the idea of a film podcast, Owen.
Exactly.
I mean, you don't have to, because Steve rarely ever watches anything, so...
Yeah, that's unusual, isn't it, that Steve's seen something the week that you're on? Isn't that what usually happens? Just the one week where Steve skips something is when Callum's here.
Just to show off.
He doesn't stick to your rules, man.
Yeah. I had about a 2-hour window at the weekend where I knew I could squeeze something in. And I did similar. I just flicked onto Netflix on Saturday morning. I had a look at the recently added list. And lo and behold, staring me in the face was Piranha, the Roger Corman film, or produced film, directed by Joe Dante from 1978. I hadn't actually caught anything else by Roger Corman for a long while now. There wasn't a rewatch anyway. So it's the first time I was watching one of his films from that era for the first time. And I think that's the weird thing, that is the fact that I'd never seen Piranha before. Because I love creature features. I love Roger Corman movies. I like B-movies. You know, stuff like Arachnophobia, Anaconda, Tremors, Rogue.
Piranha 3DD.
The first Piranha, not so bad. Piranha 3DD. The best thing about that is the poster. I know it's really sleazy, but I just think that is such a beautifully designed poster. I just love the colours of it. I don't know what it is. It's just, I shouldn't like it, because it's just a woman's tits and a... lips that are... Anyway.
You realize I set that up for a simple... For just a simple that shit there. There you go, doing a giant, very awkward tangent about boobs.
Yeah. But I don't like the poster for that. It just looks very John Carpenter-esque. Anyway, I am
Piranha?
Going off... Yeah, more about Piranha. So, you know, these films about so-called super beasts, there's just something about them that I enjoy. You know, just nature going batshit crazy. Usually, it does involve women in bikinis being munched by an animal. But somehow, Piranha had escaped me in the past. It's directed by Joe Dante, as I say, of Gremlins and The Burbs and The Howling fame.
And Looney Tunes back in action.
Thank you very much. And Looney Tunes back in action. He started out in film, though, by working for Roger Corman, editing trailers for Roger Corman's company, New World Pictures. And I think, like a lot of people, like Jack Nicholson and Sylvester Stallone and Ron Howard, Sylvester Stallone, who isn't dead, by the way, after the rumour circulated earlier on Twitter, still very much alive, apparently. Yeah, you know, those two, Ron Howard, James Cameron, who directed the sequel to Piranha, you know, they all owe a debt of gratitude to Corman for igniting their career in movies. But anyway, I am getting away from the point again. Piranha's, it essentially follows a reporter type woman. I'm not sure what her actual job is, but she's investigating something. And there's a rugged mountain man who's a bit of an alcoholic who together they accidentally release mutated piranha into the local mountain river whilst looking for two missing backpackers. Two missing backpackers who we see eaten alive at the start of the film, which, to be fair, was their own fault. If you came across a random reservoir in the pitch black in an old abandoned military facility, would you go skinny dipping in it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't expect there to be piranhas in there.
But really, though, on a mountainside where it's apparently quite cold, you wouldn't just go skinny dipping in this horrible concrete reservoir.
I mean, who were the characters who went skinny dipping?
Just two backpackers.
But like,
they didn't even know if they had names. But one of them was clearly there just to get her top off and show a bit of muscle.
Well, I mean, exactly. That's so. The guy thought he was going to cop on, didn't he? So that's
I guess
that was,
so.
That was why. I don't know what her motives were, but if she starts getting her kit off and jumping in the reservoir, you're probably going to do the same.
That's very true, I guess. There is logic to it, after all.
Well, there's logic for the guy's point of view.
For the guy's point of view.
Still no logic for why she was bloody doing it.
Who knows? Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I would have thought, what are they expecting to be in there? Of course. Of course it's going to be filled with man-eating mutant South American fish created specifically as a form of germ warfare, despite not actually being germs.
Or warfare. So,
well, that's apparently the point of them. They were genetically engineered by the American military secretly. Anyway, it kind of descends into pretty standard fare. You know, understand what the monsters are, try to stop the monsters, try to avoid being eaten by the monsters, save other people from being eaten by the monsters, then kill the monsters. That's the basic premise of it, like most creature features. It came out a few years after Jaws. I think Jaws was 75 and this was 78. And it basically just rides on the coattails of that film's success. As much of Roger Corman's movies at the time tried to do is, you know, just piggyback on other successful features. I did like the film, though. You get to see a glimmer of what Dante would later master by mixing his kind of black cartoonish humour and actual horror. There's a scene with the two protagonists sneaking around that laboratory with all weird, like, stop motion and puppet creatures in the background just climbing about who they don't notice. And it is, like, it is very Joe Dante. The characterization of the protagonist is less so. I understand from looking at IMDb that Bradford Dillman was considered a proper actor at the time, not the kind that would normally work on schlocky New World Pictures films. And apparently he wasn't too happy with the original script because he thought his character was 2D, too bland. Basically they said, yep, that's true, because the actors we normally get are shit. We don't normally get proper actors. So they rewrote his part for him, knowing that he could supposedly pull it off. So they kind of gave him a bit more backstory, hinting at like a troubled past and relationships with his wife and a strained relationship with his daughter, who happens to be at a summer camp down the river. But, it, you know, it's still fairly one note so far as these films go. I don't think they really give him or any of the characters much depth. Essentially, all you want from a film like Piranha, and the genius of Roger Corman is knowing what the audience wants, is that all you want is just some gory death scenes, a bit of humour, and some cheap thrills, often in the form of naked people, as was the thing for these exploitation films. But which it kind of delivers in spades, all the you know, the humour and the gore and stuff. And I don't know about you guys, but these movies always bring out like a primal fear in me, which is just basically being eaten is probably the worst way to die. Just seeing something chewing and swallowing bits of you just makes me feel off. It's, you know, it's just a kind of a bit perverse. And it's, I mean, arguably, it's a natural way to die in a weird sort of way, right? Being eaten, because we eat other animals eat other animals.
We don't have to assume then that Sausage Party absolutely terrified you, Owen.
Yeah, well, Sausage Party was after this, so yeah, it was a trembling wreck. But you know, it's just that idea, I think, is it's just a kind of repellent notion, and this, perhaps more so than Jaws even, plays on that fear of being eaten. Not just dying, but being eaten. It plays on it quite spectacularly. You know, just being gnawed to death by rabid fish. It's pretty grim. And actually, the whole film is surprisingly grim as fuck, because it goes really dark at one point. I know The Howling, of all of Joe Dante's films, The Howling is probably the only one I've seen that's thought, this is quite dark. This at one particular point goes further than that. Because it has the trope of people being at a beach, being attacked in the water, you know, which is standard for a movie of this caliber. But there's a whole like 2 or 3 minutes devoted to seeing children, who all of whom were probably age 10 or under, being attacked in the lake by the piranha, and they scream in agony. And even when like the heroes turn up to save them, there's still sobbing children everywhere with massive chunks taken out of their limbs and their bodies. And, you know, even though he's triumphantly there to save them, it's just like the background noise is just crying, upset, dying children. It's really quite disturbing. And more so than the rest of the film had kind of set me up to expect. I was expecting kind of camp, schlocky horror, but it really took a twist. But overall, it is a decent monster horror film. You know, you can expect tits and muff, as probably most of the audience were expecting. You can expect like a grizzled man who drinks too much. But you know, you can also expect fish puppets on sticks to be waggled at people under the water. So it's a lot of fun and worth a poke if you get kind of 90 minutes to yourself with nothing better to do.
Okay, Callum, what is it you've seen for us this week?
Well, you make it sound as if I specifically pick out a film for you. I chose to. I watch movies for myself. Thank you kindly. I am an independent man. I do what I want when I want. What I do most of the time now is just stop around doing nothing. Anyways, this week I rewatched Scott Pilgrim vs. the World for the first time in, I'm pretty sure it's 3 years. Like, as far as I can recall, I have not watched this film since I went to university, which was kind of like inconceivable to me, really, because for the long, way back when I actually kept track of this stuff, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World was my favorite film of all time. My absolute personal favorite film of all. So to have not actually, to have honestly not seen it in 3 years, it was one of those things where I just occasionally just realized I haven't watched Scott Pilgrim in ages. I go like, dear God, what on earth is wrong with me? And then me being me, not actually getting around to rewatching it. But really, I finally sat down, I rewatched it, and I honestly did so with kind of a trepidation, to be honest. Because it's what, like, because Scott Pilgrim vs. the World was my favorite film of all time, not just because of the film itself, which is, I mean, it's an Edgar Wright film, so, you know, it's brilliant, obviously, and phenomenally constructed and all that. But Scott Pilgrim vs. the World was my favorite film from basically the first second I started watching it, because when I first saw it in the cinemas at age 15, it basically felt like my film. Like it straight up felt like my film. Like having sat down to watch it, like Edgar Wright had specifically gone out and crafted a movie for my sensibilities, about my personal, playing on my personal favorite things, my knowledge of like all the useless crap I'd stored up and discovered there over the years. But it felt like it was for me. That I end up investing kind of a lot in the film. Really got into Scott Pilgrim, plus the graphic novels as well, which I ordered and received on the exact same day I went and saw the film. So for a long time, I had a lot of, like, I really connected with Scott Pilgrim in terms of the music in there as well, which basically just covers all the smorgasbord of indie music you can find, including perfectly nailing down that kind of crappy scrappy garage band feeling out there, who you could tell are semi-popular in their hometown, but do not have the skills, chops, or anything like that to make it bigger for themselves. Video game references, like specific video game references, you know, to any, you know, to years of the NES, 8-bit era, or Final Fantasy, having Zelda music, leitmotifs in the background, all that kind of stuff. Classic kung fu movies and action cinema in general, which are hallmarks of Edgar Wright's work in general, that as well. For romance, well, which played a lot on. Not that I realised it, of course, at the time, because I was kind of too young to properly grab onto subtext and that there, but the way that the connections between Scott and Mamona and the maturation and that the way they go through and all that kind of stuff that there. Like, the film really connected with me. It felt like my movie. But of course, the last 3 years, I have changed a lot. In many, many, many ways. Some ways have actually grown. Many others not, as evidenced by the fact that I'm still on here. I was kind of worried that even if I did enjoy it, that it wouldn't be the same. But I might have changed too much. That the film wouldn't have held too much resonance for me anymore. Worst case scenario, but it was actually just kind of bad and terrible. This thing that I loved and connected with for so much about that was actually terrible when you go back and look at it with fresh objective eyes. And so I sat down and watched it, and Ben was basically laughing after about 45 seconds and didn't stop until the film had finished. It's still phenomenal. And I breathed a sigh of relief and everything was right with the world. But I also appreciate it even more now as well. Like, I appreciate it for all the reasons I did back then, again, for the way that it was so attuned to my sensibilities, to the kind of stuff that I liked, to the kind of nonsense out there that I wasn't really getting in other films at the time, but you still don't really get in other films like today as well. But also specifically in other ways that the film works as both inarguably the best video game movie of all time, and probably also the best comic book adaptation of all time as well. Like, even though the further on it gets, the more it has to deviate from Brian Lee O'Malley's novel, graphic novels, because mm-hmm. of course they weren't finished at the time. It's honestly still kind of amazing how well it's actually able to still hit all the exact same points that the novel does and out there, with that has more time to breathe out there, but still in the exact same way. Initially watching it, I was kind of feared that Ramona, of course, would end up getting the short shrift and just be kind of aloof, manic pixie dream girl cliche and out there. That, of course, the graphic novels go out to avoid. But instead, watching back, it made me realize that Ramona actually does go on an arc. She grows on a journey and out there. It's just most of her character arc had been finished prior to the film, and then this one's all about her. But of course, in the film, then it just mainly skips ahead to the no longer running away part and out there. The way that Scott's arc matures and that there, how it's able to condense all this giant stuff that takes a lot of, again, that takes six whole volumes of quite like a relatively lengthy books and that there to get through, and is able to sufficiently compress it in a way that it honestly doesn't feel like it's missing anything for the most part, or at the very least in that core trio of Scott, Knives and Mona and that there. So it ends up working not just on a literal level of way, but on a literal best adaptation ever level, on the way that it's probably able to bring that kind of graphic novel one scene flowing into the next and out there as this perfectly tightly contained movie that Edgar Wright movies are just so, like, are always. And out there, like all of his movies, you could just sit down out there and everything, more so than all movies in general, because, of course, you know, all movies are constructed products and that there, where every element has been fine-tuned and fussed over and that there. But with Edgar Wright movies, it's really, like you're constantly drawn to the fact that everything has been meticulously designed so that it flows and just builds and that there, which is also exactly why I never understand why anybody who says that movie takes 30 minutes to get going. I really don't understand that and that there. It's fine from minute one. Like, it's always building, always going that there, and it's always fascinating to watch. So it works on the literal sense of how it's able to translate graphic novel comic conventions into film, but also just, again, in the way that it's been able to be so faithful whilst making sweeping changes, yet without actually changing the core dynamic of film. And on that note, how the hell did we come this close to having Scott end up with knives at the end of the movie? Like how did we come this close to that? Which was the original ending until they found out O'Malley did actually end up having Ramona, spotting up with Ramona and that there, so to go back and reshoot. Like, how did that even happen? Like, if that were to happen, that negates the entire character arcs of Scott and Knives completely in that there. How, No. Do you know what? Never mind. But the important part is the film, as we have Matt Bear, is this phenomenally brilliant little movie, Matt Bear, but still my movie, but I still have huge resonance and fond memories and connection to today in greater appreciation for. And it's once again now my favourite film ever, and all is right with the world.
I remember being so disappointed when they cast Michael Cera as Scott Pilgrim. Because I was reading the comics prior to it being adapted, and I was just like so aggrieved that they decided that they were going to cast the super bad guy. And turns out it was actually quite good. So what did I know? I mean, this was before I'd seen him in Arrested Development, of course. So
yeah, I was going to say, I've always liked Michael Cera, though. So, I mean, has he made some bad films? Yes. Has he made some very bad films? Yes. Yes, he has. But hasn't everybody? And also, yeah. I just find him kind of kind of just entertaining, puzzles to watch, especially when he's given roles that don't just rely on typecasting and that bit, which, I mean, is less Sarah's fault than it is just visionless movie executives.
True.
Especially since it helps here as well, of course, the fact that Edgar Wright especially just knew exactly who he wanted to cast for every single role, pretty much right off the bat. So, on that note, Brie Larson needs to sing more. Like in more films, like in Captain Marvel, she just needs to have a giant musical number for no particular no reason. Oh, just give her a musical number, just let her do that as well. Every second of Brie Larson as Envy Adams is hilarious. It really is. Brandon Rouse. On a related note as well, Brian Lee O'Malley is going to be at a comic convention, I believe, in Midlands in a while as well. One of my friends is going. She's apparently going to ask him what Chris Evans smells like. You know, asking me important questions that I personally need to know the answers to. Obviously, there we go. Because that's what friends do.
Here we are then. Our main release review for this week, the long-awaited comedy, animated adult comedy, Sausage Party, starring.
You could not sound more sincere.
Yeah. it's one of them things where you just think, I really wish something else had been out this week, so I had something worthy to talk about than this puerile shite.
I would have thought that you might quite like this film, because I know that you were the one who turned me onto some of these comedies, which I would never have watched anyway. This Is the End. I think you recommended to me.
This Is the End was very good, and it was some celebrities playing themselves, but being actually quite self-aware and taking a lot of swipes at themselves.
But it's the same writer combo, you know, Seth Rogen and... Yeah, exactly.
It is them two writing.
Plus also Ariel Schaffer and Kyle Hunter from A Story by Rogen and Goldberg and Jonah Hill. Sorry, just wanting to put accreditation to all the writers here. It's not just a two-man operation.
So we can slag them all off. anyway, so the film is about some food, sausages and buns primarily, who find out that when you get bought by humans, you're not going off to this promised land, you're actually going to get eaten, and they don't like that idea, so they try and do something about it.
If anybody actually wants to watch this film after this podcast here, then I'll be absolutely amazed.
Yeah. I mean, the whole film is essentially an excuse to make a sausage fuck a bun, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's it.
The premise sounds stupid.
Yeah.
But when you give the premise a lot of, like, Pixar films, it might sound a bit stupid. Not as stupid as this, admittedly. But it might sound a bit, you know, oh, there's some cars and they come to life and they don't have any humans driving them and they race around and they have their own little towns and things.
Yeah, well, that will come into this, I'm sure, because there were lots of parallels to Pixar films, including a lot of attempts to rip the piss out of them while at the same time doing exactly what Pixar might, if they were.
Plus, I mean, in fairness as well, Cars is a bad example in your attempts to use this bit here, because that is a world that really does just make no sense. So,
yeah. But I mean, the thing is, this is literally just about a sausage who wants to get off with a celibate through religion bun, right? That's it. And it's like there's lots of pretense about, no, it's got a deeper meaning because it's about atheism, it's about religion, it's about, well, you know, all that stuff is not actually really what the film is about. It just seems to be shoehorned in to allow a plot to progress. And there's, yep, great, fantastic. It's a mainstream movie. Well, as much as this is a mainstream movie, talking about atheism, which is unusual. Fine, great, congratulations. But that's not really what the film is about. The film is about having, instead of a big dance scene at the end, a big orgy with food. That's it. There's one note, this one joke stretched out. And I really want to say it's crap, but I don't think it is crap. I think comedy is kind of subjective anyway, you know, and all that. And so some people will find it hilarious, such as the guy who was in front of me in the cinema, who on his way out turned to his mate and said, "That's the best fucking movie I've ever seen." It's a bit of a stretch, but fair enough. So some people will absolutely love it because they'll find it funny. I found bits of it funny, and I just can't bring myself to say it's shit because it seems unfair. It seems unfair to call it a crap movie when it can make other people feel like that.
Are you basically just trying to damn it with faint praise because comedy for the rest of this year has mostly been absolutely terrible again, and you're just trying to give props to any movie that made you laugh at least twice?
Yeah. Basically, yeah, that's it. Twice as well. There's a bit with a condom, which I'm not going to explain. And there was a bit in the orgy at the end, which made me laugh out loud. But otherwise, it was just like kind of shock, gross out humour that you would expect from a movie like this. But in an attempt to try and make itself seem more like a Trey Parker film, which was not going to happen, it just feels a bit shallow, but it's okay that it's shallow. It's just the fact that it's trying to present itself as more than that, which I find a little bit obnoxious. But otherwise, I mean, whatever. It's just it's an adult animated comedy, which is unusual to make it into cinemas. It's there's some big names behind it. It's just okay. I mean, I know that Callum, you've got quite a lot to say, Bailey. But Steve, I mean, what is your actual opinion of Sausage Party?
Oh, terrible.
Terrible.
Just the worst kind of... I expect... Their comedies aren't the best. Their comedies aren't the best comedy. Yeah, good. I like a lot of the comedies that these people do. But this is just... I expect better of them.
Really?
Honestly, this I just found this immature, puerile, predictable, basic, just crap.
Uh-huh. Lowest common denominator sort of humour, basically.
Yeah. And sometimes I like some lowest common denominator humour. Nothing wrong with lowest common denominator humour. I mean, but it's just...
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. I think your exacerbated sigh basically indicates your opinion. So, Callum, give us the lowdown on this film. What did you think?
Well, here's why you're all wrong. I fear too many times when I come on here, I'm always one who's defending a film from you both, and I come across I come across too much as a "here's why you're all wrong" thing. So no, but seriously, like in genuine seriousness, I really, 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 really like Sausage Party. It comes with a caveat, but I don't think it's as funny as it could be. That's the thing. That's the thing of like if I handed out star ratings for whatever fucking reason, like that's why I'd have it a 4 rather than a 5 from that there, because it's like it's not as funny as it could have been. But really, my thing about Sausage Party is that it's smart about being dumb, like because it's essentially on the surface, this is a really, 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 really dumb comedy,
mm-hmm.
and that's because in a lot of ways it is. And that's also essentially why I don't think it's I won't go so far as to call hysterical, because especially in the early going, a lot of it pushes very hard on the ha ha, we're an animated comedy and we're saying fuck and shit and the C word and all these other bad naughty words.
You can say cunt on this podcast, Callum. It's fine.
In an animated film, ha ha, aren't we so naughty? Fuck, shit, ass dick. It does have a bit too much, but instead, for the most part, what it is, is that on the surface, it is just this big, dumb, stupid comedy that's doing the usual adult animation thing of aiming to just throw out a whole bunch of lazy stereotypes in every direction and out there in a desperate attempt to grab some shock humor, because cartoons can't do that. Mm-hmm. In reality, it's a lot more complicated than that. For me, the film that it most reminded me of, because when most films sit down and say that, you know, they are un-PC humor, they take no prisoners, they throw shade at everybody kind of movies and that there, mm-hmm. what that usually means is, usually that's bullshit. Usually what that means is an excuse for just the laziest punching down humor that you can find in that there. Just the ability to just make fun of everybody and go, oh, it's fine. We don't really mean it. We're just being everybody. Ricky Gervais. Again, like with no actual there's no actual meaning behind any of it. There's no there's no meaning behind any of it. There's no there's genuine contempt and hatred to it, basically, out there. That's kind of what later seasons of most seasons of Family Guy fall into. It's what a lot of modern South Park's fallen into as well, that kind of thing.
They're definitely trying to have its cake and eat it, in the sense that it's going, look, we've got this message which we've just put on the end,
Except if you let me finish it. I genuinely think Sausage Party pulls that off by subscribing to the Crank 2 school of taking up as a human. Which is also another film I rewatched this week for the first time in a long while. If you remember Crank 2 High Voltage, that movie is fucking ridiculous. It is ludicrously dumb and brazenly offensive, essentially punching through every single racial stereotype, sexual stereotype, multiple transvestite stereotypes, Asian stereotypes, gay stereotypes, sex jokes and that there, just like all of them at once and that there. But Crank 2, instead of actually just being this horribly offensive, tasteless piece of schlock, instead goes so far over the top and genuinely does spray its targets in every single direction at everybody, that it instead somehow manages to bypass offensiveness and just loop straight back around to just being hilarious.
Mm.
And I feel, I am more than happy to be disputed against this because, again, as a white male, I have a giant privilege here to be able to say, oh, none of this really offends me in that there. So if you do find it offensive, please do let me know in that there. I'll hastily retract all comments here. I genuinely believe Sausage Party actually manages to do that. It manages to actually throw it manages to just about pass the line from offensive stereotypes straight through into just stupid, into just being hilarious again, because it's all so brazenly over the top from the Mexican lesbian taco and that there, who's pretty much every word and every action played by Selma Hayek about there, is to desperately try and have sex with Brenda, to turn Kristen Wiig's Brenda into a lesbian at all costs, or the recurring jokes between Edward Norton's Woody Allen impersonating Sammy Bagel Jr. and David Krumholtz falafel as essentially Iran-Palestine stand-ins and that as well, who are forced, team with each other on their journey back to their respective isles.
But you think that is it trying to be... again, it's just shock humour to me.
I wouldn't say that. For one, I'll get to that in a minute when we talk about the religious aspect. For one, especially it works on two levels. The first is that of the main cast, all of which are stereotypes of some kind and that there, they get enough time and development in that together that they kind of push past it, especially Sammy and the falafel, in a development that I won't spoil for people as well. But I will say is that, but what I will say is that a film that is able to simultaneously have its cake by having a group, by having a producer of fruits be camp gays who snap fingers to Wham's Wake Me Up Before You Go Go before they engage in battles, and also have a genuine homosexual relationship between two characters that's not played for laughs and not made a huge deal out of. And also because a lot of the other stereotypes are basically born out of the ability to make the absolute dumbest puns possible. Like the Canadian six-pack beer, like a six-pack of Canadian beer that wanders around everywhere saying sorry all the time, or the German, I believe it's German alcohol map there, who want to exterminate the juice, as well, which is just, again, for going for just the stupidest, dumbest humor out there, in that kind of, like, in the ridiculous old-fashioned pun-based humor out there, which, to borrow a quote from Cell Specs of humor out there, is sort of like the Animaniacs kind of humor as well, where they do silly, smart humor out there, but also be really smart about their dumb jokes as well, that kind of thing. And that's how it kind of works. And so essentially, that because it's all so heightened and so smart about being dumb, but it manages to just about cross offensiveness into being just genuinely funny. Also helped by the fact that Sausage Party is a movie with all the courage of its convictions. When you say the plot of Sausage Party, where the entire idea is basically to take the fridge horror, you know, the giant existential metaphysical questions of Pixar worlds, of how they interact, and essentially take away that grey area, take away the suspension of disbelief and play it straight. You sit there and you think, okay, well, they're going to have to stop at some point. You know, at some point, they have to pull back. They can't... The film, for example, the film couldn't possibly end with the food all attempting to rise up and kill humans in order to be able... in order to save themselves and out there. But instead, the film always... There always seems to be a line you think it's going to have to stop at, but instead it keeps pushing through at all times. It just keeps going further and further and further on, right? Never stopping, never turning back, never chickening out. In that respect, in that case, and when you talk about the religious aspects, it works on both levels. Like, it works on two levels. For one, it works on the fact that, of course, Sausage Party is basically one giant affectionate takedown of modern CG animation, especially modern kids animated films, family animated films, your Pixar's, many of your DreamWorks ones, and that as well. Where, of course, the entire joke is just playing up all of the, all of those parts you don't think about and that there into, and just kind of blowing it up to high levels and that there. So, for example, pointless villains in those movies, as a Pixar example as well, Up doesn't need a villain, as a villain anyway, for reasons that are kind of strenuous and unnecessary. So what does Sausage Party have? No, it doesn't really need a villain. Here it has. It has a literal douche played by Nick Kroll, which is, incidentally, perfect casting. In a way where it just exaggerates the hamminess and the darkness and that there, and how utterly pointless he is to the plot and that there, to just constantly hijack the movie out of things and that there. So it makes fun of that. It makes fun of the... usual have to journey to separate from X, have to get back to Y plot, like the staleness of other plots, the standard character tropes, and then also especially in Toy Story, the whole idea of these inanimate objects treating humans as gods, which is basically always kind of a very unsubtle metaphor for religion, which Sausage Party instead then takes and plays straight in order to actually make a genuine point about religion, and specifically about the idea of atheism. But whereas most atheist tracts end up just being a film or somebody constantly shouting at you that religion is dumb and you're stupid for believing in it, Ricky Gervais, Sausage Party instead continues into that smart about being dumb nature out there by actually openly admit, like, by... calling out religion, but also calling out those kind of douchebag atheists out there. There's a specific point in the movie as well where one character essentially yells to everybody that religion is a lie. You're all dumb for believing it. We need to do something. In a way that instead crosses over into nihilism and repels everybody. Because as the film's eventual message is that there's nothing wrong with religion. You just, you know, with believing in something, you just always need to make sure to question it every now and again as well. Which is more nuanced than most atheist tracks are in any case. And again, that's how the film essentially works for me, is that it's a really smart movie about being, is that it's a very smart movie that's about acting incredibly dumb. A film that can legitimately attempt to tackle the conversations about atheism one moment, then the next proceed to subtly critique subtly critique the formulaic nature and, for lack of a better term, wussing out plots of these kinds of movies of, you know, what if blank had feelings kind of movies. And then at the next moment, play a Meatloaf song on the soundtrack and hope what happens to appear? The ghost of Meatloaf singing his own song as well. It reminds me a lot of aspects of another smart about being dumb comedy that came out just last week, Popstar Never Stop Never Stopping, which was also The Lonely Island Movie, for those mm-hmm. who don't know, which was also a really, 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 really dumb movie, but was smart about its dumbness.
I really liked Popstar Never Stopping.
Thank you. Somebody else actually saw Popstar. That's good. We could be ahead of a curve when everybody suddenly rediscovers it 5 years' time. And
goes, I liked it before it was popular.
Yeah, exactly. As we show with all Joel McTacone movies as well. If you have this, for those you don't know, if you haven't seen MacGruber, go fix that. But where Popstar is a very, very dumb movie, it's also very smart about it, which, if you'll allow me to just very quickly move into a Popstar bit here as well, reminds me of the Equal Rights song, especially, which on the surface is just a dumb, stupid joke of Conor Farrell trying to sing about equal rights, but also repeatedly stressing that he's not gay, eventually just listening to him naming a whole bunch of heterosexual things. Hot Wings, Monster Trucks, Leonard Skinner. But it's also really smart about essentially being a takedown of white male, of insufferable white straight male allies, of Macklemore's Same Love, and that perfect kicker after the song's finished with Ringo Starr. But, you know, he's singing about gay people being allowed to get married. Like, that's not a thing. Like, they can actually do that now. So, like, and Sausage Party plays a lot of that exact same kind of humour, for me, in any case. Again, it's not going to be for everybody. On the one hand, because again a lot of it is the dumbest thing. It's a lot of its main stock and trade is dumb jokes and shock humor. The condom bit especially was just I genuinely thought I would be able to just tell all the jokes coming, and that was one that legitimately threw me for a curveball. And I'm kind of angry with both you and myself that we've alluded to it here on the podcast in case somebody went to go to see it out there. It's a quietly smart, dumb comedy. Helps on by excellent voice cast from everybody. Excellent vocal performances from everybody. A great looking movie, even if the way that they did it, as we mentioned a few weeks back, was through essentially slave mm-hmm. labor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can at least leave Conrad Burnin out of it, if nothing else, out there. He did fine. All I can say is that by the end of the movie, I was like I went in excited but also slightly cautious, because it could have been so easy for this movie to have slipped into the worst case scenario, of just being substanceless fuck shit sex jokes. But instead, it did turn out to actually be a smart, dumb satire of the current state of feature animation, of religion, and also a movie in which every single time the villain douche says some kind of threatening word about there, the appropriate food stuff appears just off screen, because mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I could not stop laughing at that running gag about there. It's fun. It continues for me the streak of Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg being two of the most absolutely consistent names in modern comedy. with very rare exceptions, they are always like they turn in at least decent times of cinema. And I had a lot of fun with Sausage Party. And do you know what? Considering the year that we've had so far, admittedly it's still better than last year, Matt, there, but it's mostly just been meh. I will take a film that I actually sat there, doubled over in hysterics for in at least twice. Oh, yeah, I will consider that a full blown success. Yeah. Or you could just believe Steve, who says it.
So. Anyway, that's, I suppose, all we have to say about Sausage Party. We've got some recommendations, though, for the week ahead. I'm going to go with Netflix. Narcos Season 2 is on there.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I will definitely try and make time for that in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I watched Season 1 and it was brilliant. So,
The thing with Season 1, it started just phenomenally well and it tailed off a little bit, but it was still pretty good by the end. Yeah.
So, Owen, what about yourself?
I am also picking something that's been two things that have been recently added to Netflix. And they are, bear with me, the Universal Soldier films Regeneration and Day of Reckoning. Both surprisingly good. Perhaps Day of Reckoning slightly better. Absolutely nothing like the original 90s Jean-Claude Van Damme, Dolph Lundgren Universal Soldier films, which were a bit kind of tacky, but I love them. I loved Universal Soldier, but it's a schlocky kind of sci-fi film. Day of Reckoning is really violent, graphically violent, no humour in it whatsoever. Van Damme is in it as a weird kind of cult leader-ish type thing. Just, it's bizarre. Scott Adkins is great in it, though. Some great action scenes in there. And Regeneration, I guess, is still a little bit more mainstream. Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning is the slightly more arty version of an action film. So, yeah, there you go. Those two.
Okay, and Callum?
Well, for one, if you haven't yet, you should go watch Popstar Never Stop Never Stopping, if it's still playing near you. And if it isn't, you should go seek it out. But in actuality, it has a rebuttal to the fact that this summer has been garbage, both in terms of quality and also in terms of box office, which is why you might hear a few Hollywood execs running around like headless chickens tomorrow morning. I would like to instead recommend to you very quickly, don't worry, I'm not going to go into detail about them here, three excellent little mid-budget movies that came out this past summer that none of you saw, but were also really, really good and should have actually received time and attention, should be the kind of movies that Hollywood keeps making more of instead of sinking $250 million into whatever the next DC shit's going to be. So one, there is Gavin Hood's Eye in the Sky, which just hit DVD, I believe, this past Monday. The drama thriller about a prospective drone strike and the ethics thereof, with a great ensemble cast including Helen Mirren, Alan Rickman in his final live-action role, and Aaron Paul. I found it to be a brilliant, tense, legitimately conflicted, like legitimately morally ambiguous movie out there, which properly follows through on its edict of just presenting the facts and leaving you to decide in the best way possible by always focusing on the human element. That's really good. You should check that out. Two, Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special, which is essentially an arty Spielberg movie, which is essentially an art film version of a Spielberg movie. Check it out now before Jeff Nichols inevitably gets handed the keys to some kind of big budget blockbuster, so you can say you knew him when he was cool.
I knew him when he was doing, was it Shotgun Stories? Michael Shannon?
That was Take Shelter. And again, might not be for everybody because essentially it's a Spielberg movie that starts in the middle and doesn't tell you what happened beforehand, except naturally, which I know is a stickler for a lot of people, but I think was really well done. And has a great Joel Edgerton performance. And three, Sing Street, the John Carney Irish musical coming of age drama. I hesitate to use the word musical because the musical comes in for the sense that it's a band playing their own songs, I'd say. But it's a wonderful little movie. But a wonderful little crowd pleasing musical coming of age drama with fantastic performances, great songs that for the most part actually do sound like they belonged in the 80s new wave revolution, but you know, always just not quite good enough to make it unbelievable that this is, you know, a student band. And I really, really liked it. Nothing else in that there. So there you go. If you need to go spend some money on DVDs, on more mid-budget fares, you go check those out.
Okay.
Or, you know, you could just go watch Suicide Squad again.
Okay, Owen, we're back next week, aren't we? All three of us, I believe.
Yeah, and Tony Black should be joining us next week as well. I believe.
What is happening? What are we doing? What's new?
Well, Ben-Hur is out. If anyone can be bothered to go and see Ben-Hur.
Mm. I mean, I'll see it, but I mean, if we're only going to do three films, they're obviously going to be Don't Breathe, Kubo and the Two Strings, and Hello High Water, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I was just about to say about Don't Breathe. It's from the director Fede Alvarez.
Yeah, Fede Alvarez, who did that actually pretty good, but we all forgot about it immediately, Evil Dead reboot from 3 years back.
Yep, so that's one that I'm quite looking forward to.
Also starring Jane Levy, who was also in Evil Dead as well.
Yeah.
And Suburgatory, which I think is on Netflix. You should all watch that if it's on there. It's actually quite good.
Hmm. Okay. So, yes, that's all for this week's Failed Critics podcast, and we'll all be back next week for another adventure in film.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, created by James Diamond, with original music provided by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, remixed by James Yule of JamesYule.com. You can find us at FailedCritics.com, on Twitter at FailedCritics, and Facebook at Facebook.com/FailedCritics. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.